The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. Very excited about this one. One of my favorite writers. She writes for Grantland.com. She's written two amazing sports books in the last 6-7 years. One of them was about Sandy Koufax. The other one is now in paperback. It's called The Last Boy, and it's about Mickey Mantle, the Yankee star from the 50s and 60s. For you young ones who are under 25 and might not know who he is, once upon a time, most famous athlete probably in America. And Jane spent 5 years writing a book about him, and now she is on the Subway Fresh Take hotline. The immortal Jane Levy, what's happening?
Well, what's happening? Let's see. Number 13 on the New York Times bestseller list this week.
Congratulations.
And I'm in need of a new subject, and if you have any ideas, please let me know.
Well, you have written about two baseball icons, Sandy Koufax and Mantle. Now, the first question I wanted to ask, Mickey Mantle, what is it about this guy that he became basically the Pied Piper for, you know, I go to these baseball card conventions, and with white guys over 50, it seems like between 50 and 70, Mickey just owns that demographic. And how did that happen?
You know, Bill, I'm astonished, and it's something you and I have talked about a little bit. He has a purchase on the American imagination that defies credulity. It defies age, race, even to a certain extent, and time. Everywhere I've gone in the country over the last year, and I've gone pretty much everywhere, he's still the guy. There's this guy in Philly I met, Vinny, which, as a friend of mine said, limits the number of people it could have been, since I don't know his last name, to 500,000, Vinny from Philly. And he comes up to me, and he was very patient, sweet, waiting for me to sign a book, which I always feel somewhat awkward about. But as he stood there at my elbow, and he's shorter than me, and that's hard, he said, "You got behind the legend without destroying the myth." And I was incredibly grateful. I just said, oh, my God, I'm in love. Because, of course, that's what I was trying to do. And I think what Mickey taps into for so many people in that demographic, and even the kids of that demographic who have somehow inherited their Mickey love from their dads, is an optimism about a time in America when our resources were boundless, when our optimism was uncompromised, when we really believed that if you worked hard enough and tried hard enough, somebody was going to happen by the side of a road, in a ballpark, a bandbox, by our Spring River in Baxter Springs, Kansas, or by a soda fountain on Wilshire Boulevard, and see your talent and give you a chance to use it on the biggest stage in the world.
Do you think that at least part of this, because I always felt like this was part of this, you might disagree, was the fact that the World Series was such a bigger deal back then. You only had like 4 TV channels. They were on every year. And there just wasn't a lot of opportunities to latch on to other star baseball players during that era. Do you think that was a factor?
Totally. I mean, Mickey Mantle became a fixture in America's living room every fall. I mean, the Yankees were always in the World Series, or so it seemed. In fact, they were for 9 straight years, I guess between 49 and 59, I think that's right. And who was the guy? The camera loved him. If you look at the picture on the cover of the book, which, I mean, I went through 1,000 photos to find, it's of him taken in 1954 with that cap kind of pushed back on his brow and that kind of mop of, you know, perspiration-laced blonde hair and that coast-to-coast smile. And, you know, he was you were lucky if you saw one game a week and that was the game of the week. And how often were the Yankees on that? You know, it had to be like 80% of the time. So yeah, he really transcended, you know, New York, in a way that very few other athletes could have. It didn't hurt that he was the center of what was then, you know, the media, opolis of the world. I mean, we didn't have, you know, other places where the glare was as intense. And of course, that was a good and bad thing for him. The Great White Way, you know, enticed him and helped destroy him.
And, you know, it's pretty implicit in your book, but like, had Mickey come around now, I think he's consumed in a different way by the media. I don't think there was such a kid gloves treatment back then.
Yeah, you're talking about the era of hear no evil, see no evil, and speak no evil. And yeah. Sure, guys like him got away with, you know, stuff that today would be on the front, back, and middle page of every tabloid left in America, which, of course, there are a few. But I think you can make the argument, now that we've gone to the other extreme of hearing, seeing, and saying everything, every evil, no matter how big or small or human it may be, then in a funny way, he might have been better off in this culture. Well, I mean, think about it. If he and Billy Martin and Whitey Ford and Hank Bauer had been in that Copacabana melee, the brawl at the Copa, the night they celebrated Billy Martin's 29th birthday and ended up with a bowler, you know, out cold on the floor of the cloakroom, everybody in the Copa would have had a smartphone. And before they made their getaway out the back door, aided by Leonard Lyons, the gossip columnist of the New York Post, by the way, who showed them the way out of what had been a speakeasy before it became Rudy Valley's nightclub. Anyway, by the time they'd made their getaway, it would have been on YouTube. It would have been streaming all over the world. And so I think you can make an argument that it might be, just as it has been for Michael Phelps, for example, a check and balance on entitlement. I mean, what says no to these people other than the potential embarrassment of being caught sucking on a bong? You know, I mean, I'm sure Michael Phelps's mother and agent and coach weren't real happy about that, and I'm sure he wasn't. But you could say he might be better off for having been caught.
Yeah, that's an interesting theory. So you're saying that the internet and all these gossip magazines and all this stuff is actually an effective deterrent to some of the behavior that compromised definitely the last third of Mantle's career. That's when he started to wear down. I mean, maybe in this day and age, not smoking, not drinking, trying to watch his behavior, he gets his knee fixed. You're talking about a 25-year career now.
Yeah, and you know, would it be fail-safe? No, but I think it is an interesting thing to contemplate. Did it prevent Tiger Woods from self-destructing? No, because, you know, guys like him can buy all the protection in the world, and people who would have been in a position to know are also in a position to benefit from nobody else knowing. So there is that, you know, horrible catch-22. But there is certainly a chastening effect of embarrassment, you know. And, I mean, it's not like George Weiss didn't sic, you know, private eyes on him. They did. And he blackmailed Mickey with the photographs he had of him, you know, prancing back to the St. Moritz, after hours. But, there is nothing that speaks truth to power in the sense of, you know, the celebrity culture other than, you know, the possibility of being caught and having your endorsements taken away, you know? Mickey certainly wasn't a money hound. He didn't really care about money. But in today's day and age, he would have had an agent who would have been, had, you know, a posse surrounding him, and, you know, they would have tried to keep him out of trouble.
You're probably right. Tiger Woods probably had a bigger effect than anybody on the future Mickey Mantles and all those people who could get to that level, because I don't think until his life unraveled and all the people came out of the woodwork and all that stuff. It was really banged home. Like, I think Michael Jordan's career would have gone totally differently had he come along 20 years later.
Absolutely.
You're talking about a potential book. You're talking about book subjects for the next one. I still don't feel like the definitive Jordan book has been written, where you get behind the legend while not destroying the myth. That's the next guy.
Vinny. Said Vinny of Philly.
Yeah, Vinny from Philly. I like that framework.
Here's a perfect example of it, Bill. You know, in the last year, just when I thought I knew, if not everything, but, you know, enough, readers have been great in writing in and saying, oh, but you missed this story. And one of the people who wrote to me was a guy who was a Baltimore cop in the mid-60s, a rookie cop just out of the Marines. And he arrested Mickey Mantle on the street in Baltimore one night for public drunkenness. And what's great about the story is, you know, he was told as a young cop, public drunkenness is a serious thing. You got to bring him in. And so here's Mickey falling down drunk, surrounded by teammates, and thinking this is hilarious. And the cop is saying, young and nervous, and he's saying, you got to get him up off the street. You got to do something. I'm going to have to do something about this soon. And the Yankees are laughing and joking, and Mickey's saying, no, he wouldn't do that. And finally, he called the paddy wagon from a call box. Remember them? You know?
Yeah.
And the paddy wagon comes, and the cops manning the paddy wagon take one look at this and says, do you know what you've done? And he goes, mm-hmm, you know, he knows who Mickey Mantle is. And they get him to central booking, and the old salt lieutenant calls this kid aside and says, do you know what the bleep you've done? And the kid by this point is feeling, to say the least, abashed and wondering, you know, what his father's going to say, because Mickey Mantle is his father's hero. And
yep.
So the old salt lieutenant makes a decision. He says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to let him go. And we're not going to book him. And we're not going to have any mug shots. We're just going to pretend this never happened. And that's what they did. And what's interesting is that, A, public drunkenness was considered such a serious thing back then, and, B, that his remorse was not for the fact that he arrested, that you know, he was let go, but, oh, my God, I've arrested my father's hero.
Right. That certainly, if that happened now, TMZ would be alerted within 10 seconds, as
no kidding.
Three gossip columnists, and it's just done. You know, a couple other things that played in the Mantle mystique, I think. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, but he was handsome, and women liked him. Guys wanted to hang out with him because he's a star. He seemed like if you hung out in Mickey's crew, you'd be getting the girls with Mickey's crew, things like that. And then, you know, I think when he stepped on the sinkhole, and he had all that potential, and we'll just never know if he would have reached it or not, kind of adds to the mystique, right? Like, he got 80% there, but we don't know what it was. We don't know how far he could have gone.
Well, Mantle is the incarnation of the what if of not just his life, but all of ours. What if we'd gone to the different school? What if we had gone back to a different guy's dorm room, you know?
Yeah.
All those things that we look back on and say, woulda, coulda, shoulda. Now, what happened to him on October 5th, 1951, is that he caught his right spike on the top of the drain that was embedded in right center field. Now, remember, Joe D is playing his last games as a Yankee, his last World Series. Willie Mays, New York's other rookie center fielder, is the guy at the plate. Casey Stengel, the manager, has told Mickey, go for everything. Joe's heel is hurting him, only he didn't say it so politely. And
yeah.
So Mantle, who could outrun the wind at that point, he was an unprecedented alloy of speed and power, takes off after the ball, only to find Joe DiMaggio camped beneath it. Now, Mantle never publicly blamed DiMaggio, but privately he told people that he felt that Joe D waited to the last minute to basically call him off because at that age he didn't want to be embarrassed about not being able to get to a ball that he had called for. So Mantle tries to stop his own momentum, and in the process he feels, he told me later, like his knee has gone through the front of his leg, and he goes down in this heap on the green grass of Yankee Stadium, lying in a fetal position. And DiMaggio catches the ball, puts his hand on the kid's shoulder, and says, don't worry, kid, they're coming with a stretcher. And Mantle said later, it was the first conversation they had all year. Now, he told me in 83 when I interviewed him for the Washington Post that it was so painful that he soiled himself. Well, in 1983, I was too young and too dumb to figure out a way to write that for the Washington Post, so I just never mentioned it. But what had to hurt? What could be so bad to cause somebody to lose that kind of bodily control? And the answer is he blew out his knee. He tore the ACL, MCL, and cartilage. And the guy played the next 2 years on an unrepaired and unreliable, an unstable right knee, because they didn't give him any surgery of any kind until November of 53. He always said, oh, he went to Lenox Hill Hospital, and that was when, you know, he found out his dad, the miner, was dying of Hodgkin's disease. That's true. But he always said, and so did the team doc, oh, he had his first knee surgery then. Didn't happen. I went through every day of the New York Times coverage three times because I couldn't believe that it wasn't there. And finally saw that they sent him to Johns Hopkins at the end of October, and the docs at Johns Hopkins says, no surgery necessary. Go home and rest. Well, he didn't go home and rest. He went home, but his knee hurt so much that he had to wear a brace. And the brace hurt so much that he took himself to Lawrence, Kansas, to see Fog Allen, the basketball coach, who was also an osteopath, in hopes that somebody could fix his knee. And the truth is, nobody could diagnose it in 51, and nobody could have fixed it in 51 in a way that would have allowed him to come back and play. But when he did come back and play, the next 17 years of his major league career, it was on a knee that was never going to be what it had been. And so the turning point of this young man's life, because, of course, he was just 19, was really at the very beginning. And he spent the rest of his years in Yankee pinstripes trying to be as good as he could be while knowing it was never going to be as good as he might have become.
And maybe that led to some of the drinking. Possibly.
I don't buy that. I think, you know, what they say in rehab and in Alcoholics Anonymous is alcoholics drink because that's what alcoholics do. Could it have been cultural? Sure. Everybody drank in America. It was a liquid time. Everybody drank in Commerce, Oklahoma, because what else were you going to do when you got out of those mines? You know, and so there were plenty of opportunities. God knows every white guy in America wanted to be able to say he bought Mickey Mantle a round or two. And Mickey didn't understand, because nobody did when he was growing up, that it was a disease, that it was a genetically predisposed disease, and that the fact that his mother's side of the family was rife with alcoholism. His aunt, one of his aunts, Blanche, was found dead in her bed of alcohol poisoning a week after she died, found by Mickey's half-older brother, Ted, as a matter of fact, who was also an alcoholic.
And you you loved Mickey growing up. You had a chance to meet him, which for a feature you're doing in the Washington Post, I think 1983, and it did not really go the way that maybe you thought it was going to go. And you tell the story in the book, but tell it for the podcast.
Sure. You know, here I am at the Washington Post, and this thing comes across my desk, a press release saying that Mickey is going to be available, you know, media availability at the Claridge Hotel and Casino in Atlantic City, which happens to be, Bill, where my parents had their one-night honeymoon on December 25th, 1941. And, you know, the invite said, come meet the Mick, and you have a one-on-one and a filet mignon and hearts of palm salad and a number 7 T-shirt. And I stood up in the Post Sports Department and said, that's mine, because, you know, growing up in New York, you had to have a guy, even if you were a little girl who wore Mary Jane's on the first day of baseball season. And Mickey was my guy. So I got the assignment, and I went to meet him, and he showed up late for our breakfast appointment, bleary-eyed, you know, bloodshot eyes, and he sticks out his hand and says, hi, I'm Mick. And I said, hi, I'm nervous. Am I allowed to say the real, what he really said?
Sure.
You know, or should I
we'll bleep it if it's really
okay.
Bad.
Okay. He said, why? Were you scared I was going to pull on your titty? And in that instant, I grew up. Childhood was over. And, you know, you could say I was 32, that it was about time. But if you look at it in a more metaphorical sense, what happened to me that weekend with the Mick, and 14 hours later, by the way, he passed out dead drunk in my lap, and I mean face down, while his hand was moving inexorably up my leg. You know, what happened to me is in a way the what's happened to all of the sporting culture in 20th century and now 21st century America. We put these guys up on these pedestals. We expect them to be, you know, things that no, you know, human being can be, but we're lulled because if you can hit a ball, you know, 600 feet, well, therefore you must also be, what, Einstein and, you know, Jack Armstrong. And then we're absolutely devastated to find out they're just plain guys. So in the course of the 72 hours, I was terribly affronted, depressed, cried myself to sleep, which is, sounds sort of embarrassing now, but true. And then by the end of it, and by the end of the process of writing this book, which took as long as it took Tolstoy to write War and Peace, and that's embarrassing, you know, came back to a middle ground of being able to see him not as greater than or lesser than, but for who and what he was, both as a tremendously gifted athlete, a wonderful teammate who was unfailingly generous, instinctively generous, but also whose decency was corroded by alcoholism and also by being a celebrity and the ways in which we allow celebrities to act differently and then get pissed off at them later for being such jerks.
You spent 5 years on this book, and how many years did you spend on the Koufax book?
Oh, gosh, I think it was one less.
Four. So almost four. almost a full decade, you're immersed into the lives of these two guys. Like, when you look back now, obviously it was worth it to some degree, but do you just think, like, man, I wish I had spent less time? Do you wish you had spent more time? Like, how do you feel looking back well after?
Well, I think Sandy Koufax ruined me for other men. I mean, Sandy Koufax, who I hated. And that's the first thing I ever told him. I hated his guts because of what he did to Mickey in 63. Made him look so bad, you know. Mantle standing up there looking at this stuff, and he says to Johnny Roseborough, how in the bleep are you supposed to hit this bleep? Koufax is, you know, in Yiddish, a mensch. You know, that means a whole person, literally. But he's as good a human being and as honest a human being as I've ever met in my life. It turned out I was rooting for the wrong guy. Who knew? And it's hard to find, you know, a friend of mine said to me while I was writing that book, you know, it's really a privilege to write about somebody you like that much. And boy, the wisdom and truth of those words has, you know, stayed with me. Mickey was much harder because it was a dare in a kind of way. Everybody said to me, oh, don't do this, don't do this. He's been written about so much, you'll never find anything new, which made me just, you know, crazy. And that's probably why I've interviewed close to 600 people by now.
Wow.
And I did find things that were new. I mean, you know, the lesson is that the well of history is never completely dry. It was hard to wrestle him to ground. I mean, I didn't want people to think I was taking him down. And that's why what Vinny from Philly said was so gratifying. I wasn't trying to destroy him. I was trying to understand why he destroyed himself. And, you know, it took a long time. His sons, the two surviving sons, asked me only one thing. You know, they said he had a good heart. Find his good heart. And that's in that book, too. Every instance of good-heartedness that anybody told me is there, and there were many of them. I mean, you know, my favorite story is that Jerry Lumpy was a rookie in '57. you know, he was like a utility infielder brought up, and he had no place for he and his new bride to live. And so Mickey gave him the keys to his house out in New Jersey that he had rented for the summer. Mickey's wife, Merlin, and his sons had gone home. So, you know, Jerry's flabbergasted. He goes out there. He finds 10 identical cashmere sports jackets hanging in the closet. He says, "Mick, you forgot your sports coats." And Mickey says, "Oh, you take them. I don't need them." And I said to Jerry, "Did you wear them?" And he said, he looked at me like I was nuts. He said, "Of course." I said, did they fit?" He said, "Didn't matter."
Wow. Well, what, tell me about Koufax in the sense that Mantle was the most popular athlete of that entire era. Koufax, hero to the Jewish people. In many ways, meant more to Jewish sports fans than Mantle, I think, meant to any sports fan. I still feel like he has that title. Were you surprised at the success of that book? Because I wasn't surprised as it was happening. I was surprised that nobody had written a Sandy Koufax book, because it just seemed like there was a chance there to really hit something. He had so much mystique to him. He had so many fans, and it just seems like you tapped into all of that. Did you expect that to happen?
Well, I mean, Bill, you're a writer. You know this. You know, you never expect anybody to like stuff you write. So it's constantly surprising, constantly gratifying. And I also think it has more to do with the subjects than it does with me. With Sandy, you know, there was this built-up appetite because there really hadn't been very much written about him. He did one of those biographies that athletes do, you know, with Ed Lynn, and after the 65 World Series, which of course is the one where he refused to pitch on Yom Kippur. Yeah. And that elevated him from, you know, the greatest left-handed pitcher of his time to a Jewish patriarch. If you go back and you look at the great Lebowski, you know, you got John Goodman standing there saying, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Moses, and Sandy, 2,000 years of beautiful Jewish history.
Right.
You know, and the thing that was particularly beautiful about it, that nobody believed or, you know, that he even commented on until very recently, was he's not a religious man. He didn't do this because of great religious conviction on his own part. He did it because he is, as Fred Wilpon told me, he's a very Jewish being, which is different than being a very religious Jew. He had never pitched on any of the high holidays, but they had not coincided with Game 1 of the World Series. And Walter Alston had always been able to finagle around with a starting rotation, or he would start earlier, or whatever. But because this was the World Series, and because it was the era when television was so much, you know, bringing the glare of off the field into the coverage of what went on the field, it was an enormous story. Every rabbi in America, I mean, okay, I'm exaggerating a little, claimed that Koufax was in his synagogue that day. One guy the Minneapolis St. Paul area told me, "Oh yes, I could see him sitting in the back near the door, you know, with that gorgeous head of hair, you know, and everybody it looked, and in the afternoon I acknowledged to the congregation that Sandy had been there." So I found out, you know, Sandy hadn't been in any synagogue that day. You know, and he didn't feel compelled to explain it to anybody. I mean, and, you know, be serious for a second. I mean, that's what religion is supposed to be in this country. You shouldn't have to defend it or explain it or account to anybody for your beliefs or your lack therein. He simply said, "I'm Jewish and I'm not going to pitch." And he did it out of deference to his parents and to the community from which he came, but not because of his own particular religious conviction. So in a way, it was an even greater sacrifice for him personally to give up starting game one. But by the same token, you know, he always says, you know, big schmear. So Drysdale started game one. I didn't figure that was going to be a big problem. Who knew that Drysdale was going to get hammered that day, and that when Walter Alston went out to the mound to take the ball from him, you know, Drysdale, large non-Jew that he was, turned to his manager and said, "Hey, Skip, bet you wish I was Jewish today too, huh?"
Mm.
And there is an indice of progress. When a large non-Jewish guy, presence, that blonde Goyishka guy, could joke about being Jewish, it was by inference a way of, you know, measuring how far, you know, Jews had come in terms of acceptance within the American community.
In the book, you tapped into this, but I thought it's worth bringing up again. The Koufax, one of the most private, famous athletes ever, and just the way society works, if somebody is being really private, people infer that maybe he has something to hide, which is, seems really unfair when it plays out that way. How hard was that for you to battle as you were writing this book, that this guy probably didn't really want to have a book written about him, I'm guessing, right?
No, he really didn't. And what he told me was, "I really don't want it to be written, but if it's going to be done, I would rather it be done right." And I said, you know, pretty much laid out in the introduction what he was and was not willing to do. He never gave me an on-the-record interview, but I could call him up and check facts with him.
He never gave you an on-the-record interview?
Nope. And when I went to him and asked him, you know, now he talks not all the time, but you see him quoted. He was quoted a couple of years ago on a big story the Washington Post did about Maury Wills, who is a very dear friend of his and whom he believes, and I agree, should be in the Hall of Fame. And so he was willing to talk to the Washington, you know, Post about Maury. So when I started to do the Mantle book, I wanted him to tell me about pitching to Mantle in game one and game four of the 63 World Series. And nope. Not doing it. So,
wow.
He's very consistent. You know, we've lost the ability to discriminate between privacy and secrecy. You know, privacy in the sense of the old-fashioned sense of the word, meaning that you don't choose to trade off pieces of your soul and your personal history for a spot or an item in page six, just to keep your name au courant, is a really archaic notion in our culture. People can't understand why a man would make such a choice. Therefore, he must be hiding something. He
yeah.
must be a misanthrope. Well, he's not, you know, he really, you know, wrestles with that, and it irritates him, you know. Everybody says, "Oh, Sandy Koufax, he's a recluse." They still say it to me. I go, "No, he's not." You know, a recluse is somebody who doesn't deal with people. Koufax is somebody who simply prefers not to lead his life out in public, you know, as a matter of public record. You know, a recluse has no friends. Koufax has more friends than, you know, anybody I know. And so I know he chafes at that. He did
yeah.
finally this year give an interview to the guys who did the Jews in Baseball documentary. And when they explained it to him, he apparently said, well, you know, it's about Jews in baseball. And he said, "Well, I guess you can't do that without me." So he gave them an interview. He is an absolutely lovely, lovely human being. And one of
Let's
the best read
about-
guys I've ever met in my life, by the way.
You know, you've had a pretty interesting life too. And one of the interesting things about it was that you were in that first wave, which would be an awesome documentary, and I'm actually hoping that ESPN does this at some point. But that first wave in the 70s of females going into the locker room and fighting all the battles that nobody really even thinks about now. What year did you start covering the Orioles?
Oh, the Orioles for the Post. I was a, you know, second string writer behind Tom Boswell, which, to say the least, was you know, hard steps to follow. And starting 79, 80, 81, 82.
79 was when, so like 77 was really when women started going in, and that whole everything blew up. They shouldn't be in there. There's whole debate about. You know.
Yeah, people sticking, you know, rats in their sending them rats and things, and
right.
I think that was poor Helene Elliott. And
all
you know,
of you and everybody who was involved has kind of war stories from the whole thing. What were some of your war stories?
Well, there's two in particular that are pretty funny. There was a lawsuit filed by Melissa Ludke, who was then a reporter for Sports Illustrated, because she was kept out of the Yankee locker room. And of course the Yankee Stadium was then built on public land. I suppose it still is. And so the basis of the lawsuit was that they had no right to bar her from, you know, publicly owned land. Well, while she was standing there, arguing with the Pinkerton guard, I ducked under the guy's shoulder and went in. It's always been struck me as kind of funny. Probably
great.
The first locker room I was ever in was courtesy of David Hershey, now the editor at HarperCollins, who's edited both these books for me. He was then a New York Daily News columnist, and then he became an editor at their magazine, and I was writing a piece for him about how jocks had gotten all pretty and sissified, you know, with cologne and hairspray and, you know, do-rags and the whole nine yards. And so he escorted me into the New York Knicks locker room after the last game of the regular season. I think it was 78, Bill, but, you know, I could be wrong. And so here I am in this small locker room, and the only thing that really I found completely daunting was Lonnie Shelton's thighs. You know, everything else didn't matter to me. The size of those thighs was just redwood-like. You know,
right.
John Muir would have been keeling over. But I stood there not quite knowing what to do, and, you know, being kind of shy, and guys on deadline running around, you know, getting quotes, and I didn't want to be rude and interrupt their, you know, the etiquette of, you know, deadline guys going first. So I was standing there kind of minding my own business when a person, sopping wet, long, thin, white guy with lots of hair, Phil Jackson, came and, you know, said to me, "Is this your first time?" And, you know, I was just, now I'm mortified.
Right? Yeah.
And I sort of, you know, I thought about, what do? Do I lie? You know, I go, you know, so I was the good girl that my mother raised me to be, albeit not one in the locker rooms. And I said, "Yes." And he patted me on the head, and he said, "Well, I just want you to know you're doing very well." And so then he disappeared into the shower, and he came back a few minutes later, still equally wet, still equally naked. And he said, "And by the way, what are you doing here?" So I explained my assignment, and he nodded, and he goes over to Earl Monroe, who was sitting in his cubicle with this gigantic trunk of things, and said, "Hey, Pearl, yo, Pearl, you got some smells." And, you know, well, hey, this was, you know, he was in business. So he opens up this trunk, and out come, you know, 50 different kinds of cologne and, you know, cocoa butter and this and that. And Phil is now mincing around the locker room, spraying his wrists, you know, like somebody in Saks Fifth Avenue would do while you're rushing through to get out of there. And he's spraying everybody, and he's kind of dancing around the room. He handed me my story. You know, he said, and finally, after he put on this act for a while, he looked at me and said, "Got enough?"
Right.
And I've never had a chance to thank him personally. So I hope it'll get through to him someday.
That was lucky that Phil Jackson was there. You could end up with a very different NBA locker room situation of maybe not people that were super smart.
Oh, I had my share of,
sure,
you know, unpleasantnesses, but, you know, I long ago discovered that if you talk to these guys like you're one of these guys, they're completely, you know, they're absolutely flabbergasted and don't know what to do. I had a thing in the Orioles locker room a long, long time ago. It was the year of the very prolonged strike. Well, you know, people are under some illusion, and I know you know better than this, that going in the locker room is somehow an erotic experience. You know, these are places where there are large, sweaty men eating food in the buff, you know,
right.
And it's not, and dirty towels and dirty jocks and, you know, stuff strewn all over, you know, it's not a sensual experience. And so after a period of being out of the locker room for a really long time, you sort of take a deep breath as crossing the threshold. And, you know, in that Oriole team, you know, one of the guys that I talked to a lot and who is really quite a lovely man was Ken Singleton. So I went over to Singy and I kind of, you know, the Oriole locker room back in the day was nothing, you know, fancy. They had captain's chairs in black and orange canvas. And I sort of perched myself on the edge of a chair next to Kenny's locker and was schmoozing with him. And somebody comes over and puts a big, you know, calloused hand over my face and over my eyes and starts basically running his other free hand up and down my person. And
oh my God.
And it's clear that he's not letting go until I guess who it is. Well, of course, they had expanded the 26-man roster early because nobody was in shape to play. So now I have to guess out of 40 guys, who could this possibly be? And it's, and you know, they test you. They test themselves every day in competition, and they test to see how you're going to respond. So, you know, I was standing there mortified thinking, what do I say? And finally it dawned on me, George Brett, that was the year that he was in the hot pursuit of hitting 400, and
yeah.
He had gotten injured and he was photographed walking out of Kauffman Stadium on crutches. And so he took a swing at the woman who took the photograph. So I yell out at the top of my lungs, it's George Brett! And the culprit here, Rick Dempsey, took his hand away. They all started laughing, took his hand away from my eyes and walked across the locker room like, you know, Schroeder in Peanuts, dragging a white towel behind him and saying, she only goes with MVPs. So I walked over to his locker and patted him on the head, and I said, don't worry, Dipper, I'll go with you too when you're MVP. So flash forward to 1983, he's MVP of the World Series. And I got a telephone call. I'm MVP.
But oh, no.
From that day on, I never had a bit of trouble in their locker room.
Because you handled it well. And yeah. It's almost like you passed some sort of test with them.
Precisely.
When you were back in the late 70s, you know, it just seemed like it was, I don't want to use the word dangerous, but definitely unfavorable for any woman that went in there. And, you know, what I don't understand is, let's say I'm you and I'm a great writer and I'm in my mid to late 20s. Why go into sports writing over writing about other stuff? Like, why even deal with that stuff? What drove you to go into the locker rooms and kind of like blaze that trail? Like, did you feel like you were blazing a trail at the time?
No, other women actually preceded me. I think I was part of the second wave. Robin Herman at the New York Times, Laurie Mifflin at the New York Daily News. A lot of the earliest folks actually covered hockey, interestingly. You wouldn't think of hockey as being more progressive, but they were, perhaps because they needed coverage more. So I wasn't in as rough a spot as some of those women who really were first. I did personally liberate Canada, however. But this is, you know, this is an example of why and how it's handled badly in many places and makes it worse. You know, the locker rooms are always open to everyone in the playoffs. And the rule back in the day was that the teams could make their own rules during regular season, but once the playoffs started, you know, it was major league rules. Well, nobody had bothered to tell these guys that. So here I come into the Montreal Expos locker room, and these guys start diving for cover under the buffet table. Well, who blamed them? You know, nobody had warned them. And frankly, you know, I've said to lots of people, you know, would I prefer to speak to somebody in other circumstances other than them being stark naked and me not? You bet. It's not comfortable. But, you know, we don't make the rules. It's the history and the tradition and the leagues themselves that make the rules. So what I, as a female reporter, can do to make it more comfortable and more easy to have a reasonable conversation is say, look, I'll turn away. You know, put your pants on. You know, there's no deadline so bad that there isn't time to wrap a towel around your waist. My God, you know, I used to say to these guys, my three-year-old son can put on his jockey shorts in 2 seconds. Certainly you, the great, you know, professional athletes, the paragons of professional sports, ought to be able to put your pants on or something. And, you know, and most guys, given that opportunity, will do so. And then it's, you know, it's all diffused. It doesn't have to be that awful unless, you know, there is some reason that a guy insists upon having the freedom of, you know, to, you know, expose himself. In which case, you know, I would always carry oversized notebooks and, you know, the kinds of pens that you can write, you know, with it or, you know, without it, the ink
really?
Going dry.
Oversized notebooks. Interesting
mm-hmm.
trick.
Yeah.
Didn't think of that. Yeah, why
legal,
not?
Legal pads.
Yeah. How do you feel about the place of women in the whole sports media infrastructure at this point? Because it does seem like, you know, from a print and a magazine and all that standpoint, like, no, this isn't an issue anymore. For TV, it's been a little bit dicier, and it seems like with women, it's like, all right, well, you're going to be sideline reporters, and we might have
yeah.
one or two women call games, and that's it. But for the most part, you're going to be relegated over to this spot, and you're going to either be sideline reporters or you're going to be going to games and reporting from location and talking about, oh, Mike Vick, he got hurt yesterday and here and I thought. But for the most part, those are your two or three spots, and that's where you are, and that's just the way it's going to be. Do you feel like – is that fair in 2011?
Of course it's not fair, and you know, too many of the sideline reporter jobs are basically eye candy jobs, where you get to
right.
stick a microphone in some guy's face and ask the girly question, how do you feel? You know?
Yeah.
It's like, but on the other hand, I can tell you that my old friend and colleague here in the Washington Post, Sandra Bailey, Sandra Rosenbusch, is now one of the people who at ESPN for college sports is on the scene, you know, to make sure that the standards of actual journalism are enforced in the coverage of games.
Yeah.
I think that the problem is that, you know, so that it's larger than just a gender issue. There's been so many cutbacks in the coverage of sports and in the size of staffs that, you know, the progress that may have been made in you know, equalizing some of the percentages, well, never equalizing it, but improving the percentages between male and female and white and black and, you know, on sports staffs is eroding because the whole notion of newspaper coverage, as you know better than virtually anybody, is eroding.
Yeah. I would argue with the sideline reporters, I don't think that's a gender issue as much as what is the point of that of this job issue. Because we've never totally figured that out. You know, especially that you see it in the NBA, it's probably the most egregious where these guys have to like interview the coach between quarters and it's like, we're not learning anything. It's not, nobody comes off looking that good and what's the point? And then college football, it's, you know, it's a little more important. You're grabbing the coach after an exciting game, stuff like that, but really, what are you going to say to that guy in those 90 seconds, you know, and maybe if you're going to turn that into a combination of obvious question plus, all right, well, good job, like, then maybe that is a place to lower the limits of who belongs in there. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think that those interviews are ridiculous, and you know, there is nothing meaningful that can get said, and all that I ever retain out of any of them is a losing coach goes in and says, "Oh, we're going to have to, you know, rethink our play package, our nickel package, or whatever." And then the person who's had to ask the stupid question, you know, says, "Thanks, coach. Good luck in the second half."
Yeah.
And it all sounds very chummy and familiar, as opposed to reportorial, because it's not reportorial. And you know, I for the life of me, I mean, I would certainly guess without any proof, Bill, that the preponderance of the people who get to ask those stupid questions are women. And maybe, you know, maybe TV executives think they're killing two birds with one stone. They can, you know, put a female face on and ask the stupid question at the same time. I think it's a waste.
So maybe you're saying it's a thankless job anyway. So here's a
yes.
chance to inject some females into the game or
right.
the studio show or whatever. And oh, by the way, they happen to, for the most part, look
good.
Attractive in HD.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's demeaning yeah. to everyone involved. And whether you're a woman having to ask the question or a man having to ask the question, you look dumb. And what's the guy going to say? Yeah, we sucked. You ever heard somebody say that?
I hate the ones where it's like Kobe has 20 points in the first quarter, and then they interview the coach, the other team's coach, heading into the second quarter. Coach, what do you have to do to stop Kobe Bryant? Like, how are you getting an answer out of that question? There's just no way.
And the answer invariably is, we have to stop him.
Yeah. Well, listen, you can stop Kobe Bryant. He's a great player. But we're just going to have to ratchet up the intensity and try to figure out
a way
to
and our backs are to the wall.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, go back to, you know, Nick LaLouche in Bull Durham and get your cliches out. Well, let's see if we can polish them. I mean, no coach for his love or money is going to say anything that's going to give away, you know, what he's really thinking.
Right.
You know, if you're killing somebody, you're not going to get out there and say, "Wow, those people really stink."
Right.
You know, somebody's watching in the opposite locker room. Nobody's going to say, yes, we're going to change our coverage and we're going to go from a 4-3 to a 3-4 during the halftime. I mean, it's ludicrous. I would rather see them just forget the whole thing. Do an injury update if you have to. You know, use that time to say, okay, here's a summary of how many people got concussions in the first half. That would be
useful. I want to see you writing more columns for Grantland. Selfishly, because I want Grantland to be as good as possible, but also I really like reading you. And it seems like you're at a fork in the road here. You could, I think personally, as your unofficial agent, I think you should, I think you should do a year of columns where you just bang out all the things you ever want to say about different things. But it sounds like just from talking to you a bunch of times and even today, like it seems like you like having these big books, trying to figure out this iconic person and kind of dive into everything about them and interview the 600 people. I have a feeling you're going to do another book. Am I right?
I would say that eventually. I was supposed to be doing a novel about Babe Ruth next, which I really, you know, wanted to do. I'm not sure that's not going to get put on hold at this point. I think there is much to be said for not having to wait 5 years to write
right.
something. And I'm grateful for the opportunity, therefore, to write for you guys.
Can you do both? Why don't you do
yeah,
both?
Yeah, I can do both, sure.
But you need a topic.
I'm a girl. I'm a woman. I can do both.
But you need a book topic, too, and it doesn't sound like you totally have one yet.
No, I don't.
Do you
have an idea?
It sounded like, well, it's all the usual suspects, and now you're at the – certainly with baseball, I think everybody at this point has had a biography written about them. I don't know
The question isn't whether they've had a biography written. The question is whether they've had a really good biography written.
Good point. Good point. But I think the only one, you know, I think Jackie is the only one where I'm ready to read like an incredible autobiography or an incredible biography about him. There's been good ones, but they're dated.
No, there's some pretty good stuff.
It's been a while.
It's interesting. Howard Bryant, who wrote the Aaron book most recently,
which was excellent,
and John Ige, who did the Garrig book,
also good.
We were all sitting at a book fair in Miami last year, all trying to come up with a new, you know, subject. And I have this at home. It's a paper plate in which we went down the list of everyone in the Hall of Fame and tried to figure out who hadn't been written about recently and well. And we were flummoxed. I mean, I'm not taking on Joe DiMaggio after Richard Ben Kramer got done with him. I can tell you that. You know, that's definitive. And the only reason that I felt I could, I mean, like, as I said before, Koufax was, you know, hard because of the parameters that he established, or at least I thought it was going to be hard. It turned out to be the best of all possible worlds. He didn't demand anything. He didn't, and I had enough journalistic autonomy to be able to write what I wanted. People ask me all the time, has he read the book? What did he think of the book? And I say, as far as I know, he hasn't read it. Last time I asked his wife, she said, no, he hadn't read it. I apparently am the only person who's surprised by that, not surprised by that. If he was a different guy than the one I wrote about, then I would have expected him to go running to the store to get a copy or, you know, to his Kindle or whatever. Kindle actually, I guess, didn't exist back then. But, but he is so modest and he is so uncomfortable with that kind of attention that I can't imagine anything Sandy Koufax would like less than reading 270 pages about himself. So that made me feel good because it told me I got him right. So Koufax was an interesting challenge. Mickey was a very different kind of challenge. Usually dead people are easier. You know that, right?
Yes, in all forms, not just books. I think Pete Rose is the big baseball one out there other than Jackie. And again, Jackie's I'm blanking on who wrote the Jackie book, but it was, I'm going to say, somewhere in the 1980s, and it was really good. It was about his first year.
John Ige did another one recently about
Baseball's Great Experiment.
And the thing is, people have suggested Rose to me. It may have been yourself.
I was one of those people.
Yes, I remember that. And the problem is, would you want to spend 5 years thinking about that guy?
Well, we've already established.
Life is too short.
But you do. I guess.
Yeah.
It would tie into a whole bad taste in men type of thing that I don't think maybe you need to spend 5 years with.
Well, that's why I said Koufax had wrecked me for other men.
Yeah.
It's like,
couldn't do it.
Who do you do after Sandy Koufax? I'm not saying there isn't anybody else decent in professional sports or interesting, but, you know, he is a uniquely honest and ethical and intelligent human being. I mean, when I suggest a book for him to read, I'll say, hey, have you read this? And he'll say, yes, but have you read this one? And I'll name three others on the same subject. He's far better read than I am. I mean, he's an amazing guy.
The Jackie book was called Baseball's Great Experiment. It was by Jules Teigel.
Yeah.
And it was, I think that's been that's probably my favorite of them, but I still feel like there's a big one. But, you know, I got to ask, baseball is a sport that seems to be skewing older and older and is, I feel like, has lost a little relevance with the under 40 demographic. Football is clearly the most important American sport right now. There's no question. And you could even make a case with basketball. Basketball has 70 to 75% of the most marketable athletes right now. Like,
yeah,
why
let's see how many people they have after this season gets canceled.
Well, you're right. That's going to drop. But why does it have to be a baseball autobiography? Why don't you go into another direction?
Oh, I haven't ruled that out.
Okay.
But publishing is in free fall, in case anybody hasn't noticed.
Not for you.
You're
two for your last two.
I attribute that to the names, the subjects that I've written about, and they are great exceptions to the rule. I mean, I have friends who are wonderful, great reporters who work every bit as hard and as long as I do, and aren't as fortunate because the subjects aren't as transcendent. Football. When you say to the people, I'd like to write about the issue of concussions and the women who've taken on the NFL, which is something that would interest me, the answer you get back is, well, football books don't sell. So what do you say to that? And if you look at it, other than the David Marinus's Lombardi book, can you name a football book since Fred Exley that's been a huge seller?
O.J. Simpson's book would sell.
If
you did it as a pure sports book and toned down all the other stuff and did it about how this guy at once upon a time was one of the biggest athletes alive, not just even after he retired, still was a top five most famous athlete. And now
I have to tell you something. I'd rather do Pete Rose.
Yeah, that's another bad 5 years. Being in a jail cell with O.J. But
yeah, that's quite a pair.
Maybe he did both of them, knock them both out at the same time. Yeah, I guess. I don't understand why, you go to any bookstore. I don't understand a lot of things about the book business because, my two experiences with it were terrible, and it made me never want to write another book because it's so dysfunctional and so stupid and so counterproductive to where, logic is that I don't know if I ever want to go through that again. I've never dealt with more illogical everything than I dealt with my two books. I don't know. Maybe there's a reason these books aren't selling. Like you go to a bookstore and you look at the sports section and it's 95% baseball books. Why is that? Those books can't possibly all be selling well. I don't get it.
The reason that baseball is the best sport to write, Bill, is the same reason that people are in a generation, in the gigabyte generation, are impatient with it. It's the spaces and the lapses and the, pauses between pitches, between plays, even between half innings that allow for the play of imagination and for words and thoughts to form. It's not because it's poetry as opposed to, Julius Irving. It's not because, hitting a ball 500 feet is greater than what, Jerry Rice could have done. It's because in the moment, when you're writing about it, there is room for imagination. And so the sport, for all the reasons that you can acknowledge that, the timelessness of baseball is getting pretty timeless with these 4.5, 5-hour games. And it's absurd, and I think it's insane. I mean, I'm on the Major League Baseball Origins Committee. I'd like to go back and find out what the earliest game was that was timed and, how long it took. Yeah. I mean, this is insane. Enforce the rule. Don't let John Beckett circle the mound like a dog looking to mark its territory between every damn pitch.
Aren't you overrating the subject a little bit, though? Because if a sports book is really well written, I'm going to want to read it. And I think a great example is the Agassi book. If you had just told me in a vacuum there's going to be an Andre Agassi autobiography written by another writer, I would have been like, there's absolutely no way in hell I'm going to read that. And yet it was a really good book. So it's almost like
book. If
you have some imagination and you have a good writer – and, you write a book the right way. you know, the Koufax book's a good example. When I remember hearing about this book, and I'm not Jewish, but, and I hadn't really thought it through, but just my instant reaction was, Sandy Koufax, that's a bestseller? And then you think about it, and then you read the book, and you go, oh, I get it now. And, you know, I don't think
I'm overrating the subject, and nor am I saying that you can't write well about basketball or football or the games that my mentor, the late Mitt Red Smith, said, you know, those back and forth games. All I'm saying is that on deadline, in the moment of describing what is transpiring in front of your face, baseball allows writers, because of the, you know, the pace of the game, to construct language that other sports do not allow you to have. So I think that accounts for why, you know, people talk about baseball sports writing in newspapers anyway as being better, you know, and having produced better copy than you know, other sports. So, you know, it's interesting. A pal of mine, Dave Kindred, who I consider to be one of the great sports columnists in the country, emailed me the other day to ask me if I could remember what Red Smith said about his lead of the column he wrote for the New York Herald Tribune in October 51 about the Bobby Thompson home run, because it had been selected by some group as one of the 10 greatest sports columns of all time. Now it is done. Now the blah, 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 blah. And, you know, Red came to the conclusion later that it was hopelessly overwritten and wished he had just said, you know, or said to me, why didn't I just say reality, you know, surpassed fiction instead of a paragraph of, you know, of what he later called purple prose. But the fact is, you know, that was in a case where he had the time to construct, you know, the paragraph. And I'm not sure that I agree with him about it. I think it was pretty cool the way it was.
Well, I hope – I would love to think that we're going to keep seeing good sports books. And especially, like, I think the NBA is – I know when I spent 3 years researching and writing my NBA book, like, I became so fascinated by the guys from the 60s, Oscar Robertson, Elgin Baylor, Bill Russell, the stuff that they had to deal with, not just as athletes but as African-Americans and – you know, they're in this sport where they're just being totally taken advantage of by the owners, and everything led to they basically did the first labor strike of any pro sports league. And I just couldn't believe it as I was reading about it that nobody had written a book about this.
Yeah.
And or about Oscar. I think Oscar, he wrote an autobiography. It's really not that good because it's in his own voice. Elgin is somebody that would be a spectacular biography. Jerry West just came out. I just got it. I haven't read it yet, but everybody said it's really good and really fascinating. I wonder, the more, you know, now that basketball has been popular now for 30 years, really in the mainstream since Jordan started, I wonder if we're going to start seeing NBA books and maybe that will replace some of the void. I don't know.
If you look at the, you know, the ones that were great when you think about basketball books, you think back to Halberstam's book.
Yeah.
And to Bill Bradley's book.
Yeah.
And then once you get into the world where, you know, the guys who are so surpassingly good, like Michael Jordan, you know, can buy, as I said, you know, protection. And getting through the layers of PR and access and this and that and agents, whew. That's tough, you know.
Well, it's really they're brands. They're trying to protect their brand.
I can understand that, but it doesn't make for necessarily for good copy. I don't know. What do you think I should write next, Bill?
I think you should just write for Grantland for the next 2 years while you figure it out.
Well, I'll write for Grantland until I figure it out, okay?
I thought
and then maybe I'll figure out both.
I thought somebody was working on an A-Rod book. Oh, Richard Ben Kramer.
Yeah, that Richard Ben Kramer, and he's having you know, a whale of a time with it. And you know, and the funny thing
is that true?
Yeah, well, Richard struggles over everything. He's just a phenomenal writer and reporter, and the end product is always incredible. But you know, the agonistes are also incredible. I just think that it's too often people try to write stories before the third act is done.
Couldn't agree more.
The Jeter book that Ian O'Connor did this year is a good example. I thought he did a good job, considering that you didn't know how the story was going to end up. Going into this season, you didn't know whether he was going to be, you know, a 167 hitter or resemble himself. And, you know, I'm sure that the market drove the decision to do it now. Well, let's have it out by the time he gets his 3,000th hit. Well, that's great, but, you know, what's the end of the story? Is he going to leave the game on his own terms, which so few of them do, or have either the say or the clout or the psychological, you know, makeup to do? Or is he going to be another, you know, athlete like Willie Mays staggering around under a pop fly in the outfield? And so too often, because the technology now allows us to do things fast, we do them before their time. And one of the reasons that the Mantle book worked ultimately was that it was 15 years after his death. And so enough time had passed to have some historical perspective and for people to feel, okay, you know, I can talk about this now. And as I said to you, I mean, I keep getting these great leads from people. I had a woman call, actually Facebook me, saying, would you like some information? I have some information about Mickey Mantle's stay at Oklahoma Crippled Children's Hospital in the summer of 1946 when he was brought there because of raging osteomyelitis in his left shin. And at that time in America, the two prevalent treatments were maggot treatment and amputation.
Okay.
And he got there, and the supervising physician was quite concerned that they were going to have to take off his leg. Now, Mickey had always, you know, he talked about this, and my mama said, no, like hell you are, and blah, 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 blah. And he minimized in the retelling, as, you know, so many of us do about our own traumas, just how bad it was, how often and how long he was hospitalized. So this woman says to me that her uncle, her late uncle, was a resident on the ward when Mickey Mantle was brought in, and that the supervising physician, pediatrician, whose name was Garrison, sent this young man, her uncle, whose name was Mark Johnson, in an unair-conditioned car, because that was the only kind you had back then, in August, to drive down to Fort Still to recover the urine of a young soldier who had been treated with penicillin. Now, in 1946, penicillin had been available, but only for soldiers at the front. Every bit of penicillin we had, you know, went to soldiers. And it did not become available to the public in mass market until, you know, later in the 40s. So knowing that a young soldier was being treated with it was an extraordinary thing, piece of information. And the physician knew that the drug that isn't absorbed by the body is excreted through into bodily fluids, and that they could recover and distill the remaining penicillin. And so this doctor, young doctor, goes down there with, brings back a jug of urine. They distilled the penicillin out of it and gave it to Mickey Mantle and saved his leg. And then when they were done taking care of him, they did the same thing. They recovered urine from him, distilled the penicillin, and used it to help somebody else. And this is the kind of stuff that, you know, if you're really lucky, as I have been, you know, readers will call and, email and Facebook and text sometimes and say, hey, you might want to add this. And so, you know, the paperback, which is, you know, just out a week, is actually significantly different and enhanced by the contribution of readers that, you know, who have reached out to me.
I don't know if I want to end the podcast on a urine story, but I think we should.
I didn't mean to be. Couldn't think of a less. A real way to say it, but you know, that's.
Now listen, it's how it has to end because we're out of time. It's the first podcast I think we've ever had that ended on a urine story, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the podcast. You're one of my favorite women in my life right now. I hope you're ready
Bill,
for us
you're
more.
Making me blush.
I know. The Last Boy, available in paperback right now on Amazon. Read it if you haven't gotten it. And you should do the two-for-one thing where you also get the Sandy Koufax book if you haven't read that one either. They do that on Amazon, right? They pair them up?
I think they do. Yeah, they also are going to have at Barnes & Noble some two-for-one deal coming up. And,
all right, good.
You know, if they buy enough books, then I can continue writing for Grantland.
I don't understand how anybody can like sports and like reading and not have read either of these books, but I'm not going to judge the listeners of this podcast. Jane Levy, thanks so much. Hopefully we'll see you on Grantland at some point soon.
Bill, take good care. Thank you, babe. Appreciate it.
So I get to sign off. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNradio.com.
Peace out.